Good evening. My name is John Seddell from the Department of International Relations and the Department of Government here at the London School of Economics. And on behalf of the school, I'd very much like to welcome Professor Tariq Ramadan. It's a real pleasure and privilege to have him here this evening with us. As you can see from not just the numbers of you on this floor and above, but up in a room on the sixth floor of the building, we have many people very interested in his work. And for many reasons. He's one of the most prominent public intellectuals we have, not just here with us in the UK, but in Europe and perhaps in the world more generally. In terms of introducing him properly, there's that could take a long time, or for all of you already familiar with his work, I could just leave it him to it. I should just say that, as you may know from his biography, he is educated in Switzerland, with degrees in philosophy, French literature, Arabic, and Islamic studies. Also studied the famous Islamic University Al-Azhar in Cairo, and has been a prominent public intellectual writing books and articles on issues particularly of relevance to the lived experience of Muslims in the West, in Europe in particular, but more broadly, and to the significance of that experience and of Islam in Europe for the world and for Muslims around the world. His most recent book, Western Muslims and the Future of Islam, published by Oxford University Press, and his current affiliation with St. Anthony's College in Oxford bodes well for his future here in the UK. We're very lucky to have him not just in London today, but more generally in this country, and hope he will stay with us and contribute to debates and politics in this country and beyond for years to come. So please join me in welcoming Professor Ramadan here this evening.
Thank you, John, for this introduction and for this invitation, and thank you for all of you for being here. As it's a very complex, as you see from the title, a very complex topic, dealing with two sides, mainly the Western Muslims and also the Islamic majority countries, I will go straight and try to go straight to the points, but first I will start with an introduction with two main points. And then the first part of it will be about our experiences as Western Muslims and Western Muslim Democrats, in which way we are speaking about this, in which way we are also using, referring to the common universal principles, in which way we have to be involved in the society, and then to speak also about the Islamic majority countries. And I'm very cautious with the concept of Muslim world. So I'm using Islamic majority countries, just the fact that they are countries where the Muslims are in majority. Not saying by that there is a specific political structure, there is a specific, you know, because it's not the case, as exactly the same when we are speaking about Islamic minorities in the West. I'm also very cautious with the way we are dealing with this when we deal with politics and citizenship. So, and then a few points about the Islamic majority countries and in which way we have, as I see it, to promote something which is a very deep and profound democratization and a discourse in the Islamic majority countries on in which way we refer to Islam, in which way we refer to Islamic principles, in which way we see the future of these countries, and in which way, and this will be my conclusion, there is a connection between our experiences in the Western countries and the future of our relationship with the Islamic majority countries, in which way what we are experiencing will have and have already has already a tremendous impact in the discourse, because we are coming with some answers, because we are dealing with new challenges, and then there is here something which is an exchange of not only experiences but also thoughts and perspectives for the future. So as to the introduction, two main points. The first one is something which could be and could seem not so important, but it is, in fact, is the use of the concept of democracy. The concept of democracy, because still up to now, you have Muslims and Muslim Islamic movements that which refuse to use the concept of democracy, saying it's coming from the West, it's not our concept. If you speak about, for example, what is going on in Saudi Arabia, some of the Salafi or the literally Salafi, and even some Islamist movements, the concept of democracy is not our reference. It's not, this is the perception they have. So here, I think it's really important. And they are using the Quranic terminology, saying we are not using democracy. We are speaking about shura, which is a way of organizing ourselves. And to put all together in agreement, you know that Nahnah, one of the leaders of the Islamic movement in Algeria, say, okay, it's not democracy, it's shura, and for you to understand our point, is shurakrasi that he was using. So putting all this together, and I think that he's not solving the problem, it's maybe mainly more difficult to understand. So my point by using the concept of democracy is to say, I'm not going to struggle on the concept. What is important for me are the principles behind what we say about democracy. And mainly, there are four main principles on which I say and I think, and I'm promoting the idea that they are not against the Islamic message, and that for the Muslims, for the Muslim reference and the Muslim mind, the contemporary Muslim mind, we have to come to this and to ask ourselves if it's in contradiction or not. My position is not. Mainly, one, rule of law. Second, equal citizenship. Third, universal suffrage. And four, accountability. Accountability is really important. It's also to say that you have a mandate, that you are elected for a few years, and that at the end you are accountable. Because in our countries of origin, you are democratically elected for life, which is in contradiction with the concept of, you know, accountability. And there are two other principles that are not straight, not exactly universal principles that you can say, okay, look, behind the concept of democracy, we are speaking about these principles. And I think that they are universal principles that you have to stick to when you speak about the future of political organization or governance, of good governance. But there is something which is really important, and that two other principles that can have a specific shape according to the reality of the country, its history, and the collective psychology. The first one is separation of powers, which is, as you know, what we know. And this is a principle, but the way it's organized could be organized in specific ways, as it is, for example, in Europe or as it is in the States. We don't have the same models, even though we have the same principles. And there is something which is really important also as well, which is the sixth principle, which is distinction between private life and public life. We put it very simply by saying, you know, it's the distinction between state and church, separation between state and church. And I think it's good to say it like this, and it's dangerous at the same time. Why? Because you can have a Muslim answer, which is, okay, look, we don't have church. So how could you separate church from state when we don't have church, so it's not possible? In fact, it's not the discussion. The discussion is not about state and church. Simply, it's much deeper than that. It's about separation between the realm of dogma, authority coming from on high, and collective rationality, authority coming from the people. It's how do you decide from where authority is coming? Is it coming from dogma that you say, okay, we have the Quran, we have the Bible, and we just impose on the people our dogma? Or is it decided through a process which is collective rationality trying to reach decisions that are shared by a majority or by the society? And here there is something which is a very old discussion, and mainly coming from two sides, and not only from one side. Orientalists and some Muslim scholars, Muslim intellectuals, are saying, we don't have this difference in Islam. There is no difference between state and church because we don't have church, and very often, the Islamic message is about everything. It's as if we don't make a distinction between the two realms, which is private life and public life. I'm challenging this idea, saying it's wrong. It's this distinction, it's as old as Islam. which is the realm from the very beginning in the fiqh, the legal framework, the legal thought of Islam, between ibadat, the realm of worship, and mu'amalat, social affairs. And from the very beginning, the scholars understood that there are two different methodologies. In the ibadat, you can do but what is written. So you don't have choice. There is no rationality, no room for interpretation. It's written that you have to pray like this, you pray like this. But in the realm of social affairs, it's exactly the opposite. It's the opposite methodology. Everything is possible as long as you don't have something which is telling you it's not possible, it's prohibited. So here you have creativity, rationality, collective commitment, rational commitment, and rational creativity, which means the collectivity could come with anything which is new as long as, for example, it's not something which is forbidden. We can discuss this for the contemporary issue. What is really important is that, yes, we have two different realms, that we have to deal differently in the two different realms. So it's something which is, if you come to the philosophical aspect of that, and you come to some of the works done, for example, by Alain de Libera in the medieval philosophical thoughts, he was saying what came out of the influence of the Islamic philosophy on the Christian philosophy is this distinction. In fact, what we call secularism was not so at odds with the very old and traditional way of thinking by the Muslim scholars and the judges. And, for example, we always mention Ibn Rushd, Averroes, as the symbol of a rationalist. But if you come to the very traditional Muslim scholars, Shatibi or Al-Kindi or Al-Farabi as philosophers, but at the same time, Ibn Hazm as someone who is coming from within the Islamic tradition of the legal framework, you will see that he is doing the distinction between the two realms. But he is distinguishing them, but there is no divorce. So it's two different methodologies, but there is something which is distinction without divorce. It's not one against the other. It's the same direction, but in two different ways. So there is a distinction, but the articulation between the two realms may be and are, in fact, different from the Christian tradition, of course, because the relationship between the Catholic Church and the state and the evolution of thought was different. So we have to understand that it's more complex to say there is no difference in Islam. Here, this is why I'm saying that this sixth principle, which is part of what we call a process towards democracy, helping the collectivity to find ways to promote new legislations, new laws according to the collective understanding. It's not against something which is part of a very old and traditional way of thinking in the Islamic legacy of laws and jurisprudence. So here, I'm explaining why I'm using the concept and how I'm using, and I'm speaking here, I'm referring to the principles of democracy, not on the specific models or historical models. Here, there is a difference which is really important for both sides, so to say. Speaking from the West, or speaking from the Islamic majority countries, I think that we have to be very cautious not to confuse the democratic principles and the democratic models. And the models are historical, and the principles may be understood as universal. And it's when we come with historical models to be imposed on other countries that they are not ready to accept that. If you speak about principles, they can listen. Okay, the principles, I can understand that. But the models, it's imposition, it's the very old experience of colonization. It's to impose models, it's not to share principles. I think that this is the core discussion that we have to understand when we come to that. But we will come to this later maybe. Second point here, very quickly about this discussion, is that if we want to open a sincere debate, I think that we have to stick to one methodology in which it's an intellectual property that we have to share. Not to compare our ideals with the practices of the other. Saying, we have these, really good democratic principles, it's coming from the West, and we are assessing and comparing or discussing or debating with you by dealing with your practices. I think that this is really the great danger. It's on both sides exactly the same danger, and we have it. Muslims, when they speak about the West, the Western cultures, or the Western democracies, say, look, our Islamic principles are so high, and their so-called Western democracy, look at what they are doing. So they are comparing their ideals with their practices. And in the West, we are doing exactly the same. Our great principles of democracy, and look at what you are doing, you guys, as Muslims. In fact, we have to look at principles and principles, practices and practices. This is the only way to have a clear and sincere debate for now and for the future. So let me now, the first part of this, it's to speak about Western Muslims. And there is something which is really important. You know, I traveled, and the last book was mainly about all the experiences from Canada, the States, Europe, Australia. I visited all this country and extracted from, not only from the Islamic, you know, classical tradition. I did that. It's the first part of the book. The second is mainly about experiences. And here, there is something which is really important if we speak about Muslim Democrats. It's first to say, when you are a Western Muslim, the challenge is that what they want to be is fully Muslim. Fully Muslim. It means that it's not to be less Muslim, to be more Westerner. It's both, fully Muslim and fully Westerner. Is it possible? The answer is that millions of Muslims are showing and witnessing and just are both at the same time. They are Muslims and they are already British citizens, and we have to look at them. And this is when sometimes we have to tell the people, look, don't be totally obsessed with the few that are destroying, but just turn your face towards the people, the millions of people who are silently building this real identity of being at the same time fully Muslims and fully Europeans or Americans or Australians or Canadians. Second point is that what is important is also for the Muslims, and this is the process through which we are going today, is that they are understanding that they are Western Muslims or European Muslims by culture, meaning that this is their culture, even though they respect the Islamic practices and they are fully committed as Muslims, if they want, practicing or not. On the other side, they are Europeans or Americans by culture. This is one, but it's not enough. Very often in the discussion we have with the Muslim communities, we are speaking about, look, take from this culture, is your culture. But now we have also to speak about, and this is coming from to the point here, is to speak about democracy and to be Democrats within the democracies, the Western democracy. How could this be achieved and done? There is a central concept here, which is when you are in one society and you are at home, you are a citizen. Citizenship is a central concept here when we speak about democracy and being Democrats. And with citizenship, we have conditions and rules and prospects that we have all together, and not only the Muslims and the new citizens. Very often when you look at the new citizens, they have duties. It's as if they have duties that we don't have. We all have the same duties and responsibilities and rights at the same time when we speak about citizenship. There is no two kinds of citizenship, which is not always clear in the policies that are practiced and implemented in many of the Western countries. So there is an ideal discourse and a less ideal practice on the ground with different kind of citizens. And look, if you have to think about it, what happened in France just a few months ago was clearly this. People on the suburbs who were French people, French citizens, were saying to their government, there is in this country a second-class citizenship. It has nothing to do with culture, nothing to do with religion. It's on the suburbs. You are not respecting the people. You are not respecting your citizen. And in the discourse we had from the politicians was, look, you are not genuine French, or you are immigrants. if after four generations you still refer to me as a French from an immigrant background, is that in your mind, I'm not a citizen. So I may have a legal citizenship, but I don't get the psychological citizenship in your mind, which is, okay, the difference, the gap between the ideals and the practices. So here, I think it's really important to come to the duties and to come to the responsibilities. And here there is a very important point, the overall picture of it, from an Islamic viewpoint. From when I'm saying, look, I am a European Muslim Democrat, and I think that we have to propose and to promote this ideal, and to say, okay, look, we have to be committed in our society. Many Muslims are saying, look, what are you speaking about? Look, you are in a non-Islamic country. It's a non-majority Islamic country. It's not. We are not at home. At home is the old concept of Dar al-Islam, the abode of Islam, where the Muslims are safe and in majority. The problem is that I am safer in the West than in the many Islamic majority countries. And by the way, that there are many things that I can say here, I cannot say them in the majority of the Islamic majority countries. So if we take what Abu Hanifa was saying, Dar al-Islam, the abode of Islam, is the place where you are safe and protected. So in Britain, I'm much more in Dar al-Islam than in Egypt, in my country of origin. Because in Egypt, I'm not safe to speak. There is no freedom of speech. There is no freedom of speech in my country of origin, and it's an Islamic majority country. So you have to assess this on these principles. You have to change your perception of reality by saying what? Let us assess these societies in the West on the principles required when you want to remain faithful to the Islamic message. And here we come to what the scholars during the centuries, throughout the centuries, were saying what are the objectives. And by the way, they were speaking about the objectives of Sharia. And here there is a central concept. Sharia is not the penal code. It's not to be reduced to that, one. Second, Sharia, it's not only a set of so-called Islamic laws. It's much more than that. Sharia, etymologically speaking, and also understood by some of the great scholars of Islam, is the way towards faithfulness. In which way am I faithful throughout history and throughout the societies to the principles of Islam, and I try to find the right law in the new context in order to remain faithful to the principle. So if I want to remain faithful to the objective of justice, I need to understand that there is no faithfulness without a dialectical process between the text and the context. So this is what we call ijtihad, critical reading of the source in the light of the new context. So when you come to the etymological meaning of Sharia, you understand that this is a dynamic process and that you have to find new laws in new contexts, because the contexts are asking you to reread the sources in order to be faithful. So no faithfulness without evolution. By saying that, I'm of course not representative of all the Muslim trends, and you know that. You know that you have people saying, wow, this is wrong, it's not Islamic. And by the way, we need a discussion here, an intra-community dialogue among Muslim scholars and trends, because here we are at the heart of the discussion of how we are Muslims in a contemporary world, in our contemporary world. If I want to remain faithful to the objectives of what the scholars were speaking about Sharia, they were speaking about what? Protection of religion, protection of the integrity of the person's integrity. It's the protection of the human being, protection of intelligence, the intellect, protection of your goods, protection of your families, and protection of your dignity. By the way, this was said during the 14th century. It was synthesized by the great scholars. Now I think, and this is my perception, I don't have time to come to that, but we have to need more principles on the objectives. We have some, we don't have all the principles, because we are living in a new complex reality. But if I have now to assess the societies, on which societies are protecting more these six principles, which are the societies in Saudi Arabia or in the great majority of the Western societies, in the so-called Islamic world or here. When you have a specific religion, where are you more respected? Even though in this society, reference to religion is not something which is a public concern, is much more on your private and the state is neutral, where are you more respected? Where are you more respected as to the intellectual protection? What does the intellectual protection mean? That you have to protect the intellect, it means that you need to get places where you can be educated. It's to protect your intelligence. It's all about education. It's to be educated. A society should provide its members with education. Look at our Islamic majority countries. When we have in some countries, for example, in North African countries, the highest level of the lowest percentage for the women to be educated is there, is in these countries. It's against our principles. It's against the protection of the intelligence. So if we have to assess the situation, you come to a perception that, look, it may be that we are living in societies that are not majority Islamic countries, but the principles on which we want to assess our societies are more protected in non-Islamic countries today than in Islamic countries or Islamic majority countries. So I think that here we have to come to something which is a critical perception of the reality. It's not a question of number. It's a question of respect of principles. And here, as someone who is part of this, I have to come and say, okay, and in one of the book, Islam, the West, and the Challenges of Modernity, I was speaking, this was 10 years ago, I was speaking about, look, what is the state of affairs of the Islamic majority countries when you have to deal with corruption, when you have to deal with people who are not respecting your simple rights as citizens? There is no way to be able to speak, and when you are three people, state of emergency in my country of origin, in Egypt, you can be just arrested, and there is no way to get your rights. So here we have to come to a better understanding of in which societies we are living and how we can assess. So according to what are the principles to be implemented, to be faithful to the Islamic teaching, if now you come to the society and you ask yourself where these principles are more respected, it's exactly the way round. It's not what we can expect, that the great majority of the Islamic majority countries are not respecting the principles we are speaking about. They are not. So here we have to ask ourselves in which way we are going to be involved in the society to promote more and more these principles, and this is the active and committed citizenship that we want in the West, is also to go and to be committed to improve the situation in order to be closer and to our ideals. Now, what is the role of the Muslim Democrats in the Western society? If we are, once again, we want to be more, at the same time, faithful to the Islamic message and being fully Muslim, and at the same time, committed and feeling at home. This is my society, I'm here at home, and I'm just trying to be faithful to the principles that I have as a Muslim, and at the same time, faithful to my commitment as a citizen of this country, because I am a citizen of this country, I should be loyal to this country. The first, which is something which you can have now, and you have it all around the European, the Western countries, which is something that it's the majority message we have. You respect. In the name of your belonging or you believe as a Muslim, you respect the constitutions or the legislations of the country you live in. It's not an exception to your Islamic belonging. It's in the name of your Islamic belonging that you respect. It's a moral duty because you have a contract. It's your home. You have to respect the laws. Listen to the majority discourse you have in America, in Canada, in Australia, in Europe, the great majority of the Muslims are saying this. This is the message. We are Muslim, we are citizens, and we abide by the common law and the legal framework. Having said that, in our society, it's really important now. So, okay, what are the requirements? What are the conditions to be much more involved in the society as Muslim Democrats, as living in this country? Here there is very quickly three fields on which we have to say something, in which we are promoting this commitment as citizens and as citizens not only accepting but promoting democracy and trying to do what, in fact? And there is a very important question here. It's about trust. And I was asked this question many times. What do you want exactly as a European Muslim? Do you want to Islamize Europe? Or do you want really, sincerely, and it's a good question, or do you want sincerely to be a European citizen with a Muslim background and to share with your fellow citizens values and principles? Of course, for me, it's the second, but there is something which is more important than that. My aim as a European citizen, as a Western citizen, is to reconcile the European ideals with the European practices, the American ideals and the American practices. It means to try to do something which is to fill the gap between what we are saying are the ideals of our societies as a Swiss citizen, you as British citizen, and what is done on the ground. So my aim is struggle for consistency. This is what I want. Is we have, well, we are sharing principles, but we know that it's not the case. We are speaking about equal citizenship. Go and try to ask for a job and say that your name is Ahmed. And if you are not so white, you will see the gap between the principles and the reality. So let us struggle to change that. This is the real struggle. This is what I want. This is what I'm asked. My conscience is telling me, speak about the ideals and struggle for their implementation. This is what you have to do. And I hope that it's exactly the same for any citizen, as a Christian, as a Jew, as an atheist, as whoever you want to be. I think that you are just looking for consistency. So this is what is, as a Muslim European Democrat, this is what I want. It's to fill the gap. And here, three fields mainly. The first one is about knowledge. If you are a citizen in a country, you need specific knowledge. And this knowledge is a condition to be a real and a true citizen. The first one, of course, is about institutions. And law, you need to know what are the institutions and the way this country, when you live in Britain, is organized, the all the institutions, the government, all this, the constitution and the law, all this is the minimum knowledge which is necessary. And this is something that we have to understand, that many of the European citizens, the American citizens, the Western citizens, they don't even know about the institutions, and they don't know how this country is just working and organized. And if you don't get this knowledge, how could you be a true citizen? So the condition is there is no way but to come back to civic education. And civic education is not only to Muslims. Of course, the Muslims and the new citizens need that, but I think that it's a common challenge. There is a lack of civic education. If we are true and sincere about democracy and to be committed to that and to get rid of this, of course, political politics, that this way of speaking and using politics in a very bad way. There is something which is also very important, and you can see this in many countries today, even here in Britain, as it is also the case in France and in the States. It's something which is, there is also a very important, necessary knowledge. It's about history. You cannot be a citizen of a country if you don't get a knowledge of the history of the country. And the history of the country should change, and the way we speak about it should change when the societies are changing. So you cannot still stick to, you know, the history of Britain is just the history of the white people. No, it's not. The history of Britain today is history of histories, history of memories. You have to speak about the legacy and the memories of the people who are now building this country. You cannot have a selective approach towards memory, because you cannot build a sense of belonging today if you do not integrate memories as the way you speak about, officially you speak about the past. And it's not to say and to speak, as we had a debate, and I know that Gordon Brown came with this recently about the positive aspects of colonization. Wow. I have a problem with this. The statement per se is problematic. Tell me about one positive aspect. And not, don't speak about hospitals and schools. Of course, you went there and you, okay, but this is the good aspects? You take over and then you speak about what you give to the people? I think that, is there something that you can name a positive aspect of colonization? At least let us have a debate and not a struggle, you know, of memories as we have now in some countries. Very quickly, because I don't want to avoid speaking about the second part of this. So I think that we need this knowledge. We need also something which is really important to stop, as Muslim Democrats and European Democrats, to stop speaking about minority. There is no minority citizenship, so we have to get rid of this. So we are at home and we are citizens, and this is the only way to be involved in the country. And we have, it's a very vicious reality that some Muslims are still speaking about minority. They are always speaking of themselves as a minority, but they are not alone. Some of the, you know, the public figure and then the mainstream, we still speak about, and very often in times of election, because we need some votes coming from some minority. So we remind the people, you are a minority and I'm going to help you. I'm not speaking about, you know, how could we, could you speak to me as a minority? You speak to me as a citizen. So your principles are my principles, and the common good for you is the common good for me. But to speak about citizenship during 5 years and just to forget about our common citizenship and speak only about your communities during the elections and to try to get votes, it's a very vicious political game. It's very dangerous. It comes to the point that we have Muslim MPs. What I said, a Muslim MPs elected as a Muslim and then representing the Muslim? Is this the reality of our future? Multiculturalism is MPs representing religious communities? It's in contradiction to our principles. We spoke about public life based on principles and not on religious affiliation. So it's really dangerous. It could be good to get voters and votes. It's bad for the common good and the common future. And here it's based, of course, about on rights and duties. And it also come, and one of the third field is about the way we vote. And it's coming, it's a relationship with what I was saying now. When I am going to vote, if I want to reconcile this society with its own principles, is to say, when I'm going to vote for someone, I need him or her to be competent, to show integrity and accountability. It has nothing to do with you being a Muslim or not. You are competent, you are, you show integrity and you are upright, and at the same time you are accountable. You are here with the people who voted for you. I'm going to vote for you. Muslims or non-Muslims. This is citizenship. It's about values and principles. It's not about my religious affiliation, or because you know that not all the Muslims that are trying to get elected are competent or upright, honest. Not. It's not this. So the way we have to think about being involved as Democrats is on principles and not on religious affiliation or religious representation. This is the future. The last point on this, and it will help me to get to the second part, is all this, as Muslim, European, or Western Democrats, should lead us towards something which is critical citizenship. It's not a blind support and a blind belonging. And it's a point that we should understand altogether, because very often when you are a Muslim and you are critical towards the policy of your own country, you are suspected not to be loyal. If, for example, I'm a British citizen, I'm saying, look, this in the name of my British citizenship, I'm critical towards my own government. What the British government did, for example, in Iraq, it's wrong, according to me, because I am a citizen, and I think that you are not representing me. We were millions, Muslims and non-Muslims, British citizens, demonstrating against the war. Very often what you get is, look, he is against the war because he or she is a Muslim. So double loyalty. Who are you first? I am a British citizen against this war. So it's not a blind support, it's a critical. And critical citizenship is the only true citizenship. It's to be able to be critical towards the government. And the problem is that when we are a Western Muslim and you are critical towards some Western policies, your loyalty is put is discussed and put under suspicion because you are critical. You say, I'm critical, and it's the way I'm showing you that I'm really a Westerner. My real commitment to the fact that I am a European is to be critical. But there is two kinds of criticism. An accepted criticism when you are white European, and not so loyal criticism when you are a Muslim, Arab, European, or perceived as such. And I think here we need something. And the key issue here is trust. Is trust. Is not and both sides. As I was saying, domestic policy, as a Muslim European Democrat, a European Democrat here, it's really important to reconcile our societies with their principles. All kind of racism are not acceptable. There is no hierarchy between racisms, unacceptable. Discriminations, unacceptable. And we have to work together, all the citizens, in the name of our common principles against this. This is domestic policy. And a Muslim Democrat, a Democrat in our society, should show concern about domestic issues. And this is the problem we have with many, 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 many Muslims, obsessed with the Middle East, obsessed with international issues, and not being there in, for example, schools. The only answer we seem to have about schools is, when we have problem in the mainstream school system, let us have our own Islamic schools. Where are we? This is not to be part of a society. The society is, yes, we are facing crisis. Let us try to find a solution as parents, as teachers, as citizens. Because schools, it's not a problem between teachers and pupils. It's a social problem. It's a problem of a whole society. So here's something that we need to come together and to try to meet this kind of involvement. And this is the way forward. This is what we need. And once again, it's also to be able to be critical as to the international policies. And as a European Democrat, I must ask, it's a moral duty, to ask my government in Switzerland. I did that a few years ago, and I was asked to keep silent about our relationship. We are speaking about democracy. We are democracies. How could we continue to deal with dictators and dictatorships the way we are doing? It's just discrepancy. It's not consistent. It's not acceptable. So I must be trusted when, as a European, I'm asking my own government, and I think that all the citizens should do exactly the same, ask your government to be consistent. You want democracy. We are proposing and promoting democracy, democratic values. How could you deal with these countries without being self-critical in the way you deal with these countries? Because, okay, you said that you are going to free the Iraqi population. This was 2 or 3 years ago. What have you done before? This is a critical stand, and I need to do that. This is the only way to be honest. This is the only way to be a Democrat. It's not democracy for me and forgetting about the other. And by the way, I will never, never, never forget about my own history. I'm coming from a political exile. So as a European citizen, I'm not going to forget about, I want to be the voice for the voiceless, but not alone, not Muslims for Muslims, but Democrats in the name of common principles with all the Democrats, with all the people who are sharing these values, and that we have to speak not only about what is going on in the Islamic majority countries, but I have some concern and very strongly advocate the fact that we don't have to keep silent when we know what the Tibetans are enduring in the name of a Chinese colonization, and we keep silent because China, it's a big market. This is the reality of it. So it's also a critical way of being a citizen. I don't see any other way to be a citizen. So self-criticism is also something that is needed. And, you know, I was raised in Europe, and this is something that I learned in the mainstream school system. Be self-critical. Be critical. Ask questions. So this is what I'm doing. So the very fact that I'm doing that is just showing the people around me that I'm really a European citizen, a European Democrat, doing exactly what I learned from my experiences in this country. So don't put my loyalty in question because of that. So now we come, I still have 12 minutes, I will try to stick to the time. Let us come now to this self-criticism when we speak about the Islamic majority countries. And I think that here it's really important. You know, I'm visiting the Islamic majority countries a lot, from North Africa and Indonesia and in the Middle East, in the countries I still can enter, because some of them are, it's not only that the states are preventing from me from entering, but Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Tunisia. Difficult time, because we are not dealing with democracy and we are not dealing with countries where we can speak freely. And I think that when you visit the Islamic majority countries, there is something that you feel and you can assess out of the common discourse. Yes, there is a binary vision of reality and the West. There is a caricature in the average discourse, the caricature of what the West is all about. It's against the Islamic world. This perception of two worlds, and, you know, yes, they speak about democracy, but that this has nothing to do with the reality. You know, this kind of discourse, which is not based on principles but on perception, is a reality, and we have to face that. When you come to the discussion about policies and about changing the world and being Democrats and promoting democratization, you cannot avoid perceptions. You cannot avoid perceptions. Perception is part of the discussion, and to deconstruct the perceptions, it's really difficult. You cannot do it overnight. And sometimes you have to come from within to try to change the perception of the other when you are changing the perception of yourself. And this perception of binary reality is there, as if exactly the discourse that we have in some, you know, this all the business about, you know, the clash of civilizations. We are taking hours to deny the fact that there is a clash of civilizations, and by trying to deny it, we are just putting it in our minds, you know, to deny something. It's at one point it becomes a reality in our minds, and very often is that what we're experiencing. And the other thing that we are facing in the average discourse, and mainly also among intellectuals, is the perception that the West is to be blamed for what we are facing. This victim mentality is there. And mainly around the Middle East, for example, the Palestinian issue, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, say, okay, look, the cause of all our problems is there, is this, is Palestine. This is the cause of all our problems. And I wrote an article and I got criticism from the Islamic world and the Islamic majority countries. I got criticism because I was saying, no, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not the cause of our problems. It's just a consequence. The cause is, you know, upstream from this. The consequence is what we are experiencing: total disorganization, total division, no real political stand coming from what we call the Arab countries or the Islamic majority countries. Nothing. It's just total disorganization. We are blaming the West not to support the Palestinians. What about all the other countries coming from the, you know, the Arab countries? What are they doing? Just following what is that? So it's the consequence, it's not the cause. So this victim mentality is something that, if we are speaking about democratization, is to build something which is get rid of this perception of the other and get rid of this victim mentality and to build something which is, once again, on principles and active citizenship, what we need. And there is one point here, is if we want to get rid of that, it's really important to understand that we need to promote something from within. And I want to take one example which is really interesting. I don't know if you heard, of course you heard about this, but the process from within, you know, I was visiting Morocco during the last years many times, and you heard about the whole discussion about women. You know, women and the family laws that we had there, marriages, the personal, what we call le statut personnel, personal status for women and for the family, and divorce and marriages. They had very big discussion, and some from the French elite, speaking mainly French and not Arabic, were coming with an agenda that we have to reform that, this is the only way to do it, and they got the resistance from Islamists and traditional scholar, Muslim scholar, saying, no, this is, again, colonization, it's to impose onto us the French culture. What happened is that they were blocked, there were no discussion between the two trends, and 500,000 people demonstrating against the law coming from, or perceived to come from France, and the elite getting people within academia speaking against the traditionalists and the Islamists. What happened is really interesting, is that they decided to set up a commission with Muslim scholars, women, and people from within the country, and say, okay, stop speaking that way. It's not a binary vision. It's not the West against the tradition. It's principles. We need to speak about the principles. Out of what was called El Mudawana, the discussion coming from within, in 2 years, they were able to come with something which was an evolution on that field, the status of women, but coming from within, with people speaking together. And this is really important to understand the process. If we want democratization, is not going to be imposed from outside. It will be a long process, but it will be let the people speak. But to do that, there is a condition, the space to speak and to debate. And as we are in a kind of vicious circle, if you don't get this space to speak, you cannot get the perception of, you know, this evolution from within. And as you don't get this evolution from within, it's very difficult to get democratization and an open public debate. But it's really interesting to look at that, because just after this experience in Morocco, they started the same process in Algeria. So coming from within, the discussion coming from within, and say, okay, we can evolve, we can just, in the name of Islam, to rethink the traditional way we were thinking that it's the only way to be a Muslim. And, you know, more about rights and about not only about the duties, and, for example, to say something which is really important. We are saying, as Muslims, that it's not possible to promote something which is forced marriages. And to get free marriages, that to be able for a woman to say, I want or I don't want to marry, we need to be to get a kind of autonomy. How could you get this autonomy when you are 12 years old? It's not possible. And they say, in the name of Islam, in our time, is 18 years old. No one discussed that. And coming from within, with Muslim scholars saying, this is the way to do it now. Look, it's really interesting. If you were to say this in Paris to the Moroccan Muslims, okay, this is French. So there are ways of doing this from within. But the Muslims should do it, of course, the Muslim in the Muslim majority countries, but the West should be able to decenter itself from the only agenda, which is to impose models, but let the principles come from within and let the people try to find their way. To do that, what is needed? And this is something that is needed now in the Islamic majority country. The way forward is really to build a clear discourse on many important issues. And just to name a few, which are now in the public sphere, part of the debate. From within the Islamist movement, or from within the among the intellectuals and within the society. It's the relationship between Islamic State and secular state, which is important. What do you mean, if you mean, and some are meaning this, what is the meaning of an Islamic State? Is this something which is, because for example, we had this discussion with the Islamic, the FIS, the Islamic Front of Salvation, in Algeria. They were saying, okay, we will use democracy to take over, and then we will change the rules of the game, which is it's not acceptable. It's not acceptable to say, okay, we take over, and then we change the rule, and we will not accept democracy anymore. So democracy, as Ali Belhaj was saying, democracy is not a concept which we can find in the Quran. So it's not us. So this perception that we are using the rules and take over, and then we change the rules. Here we have this discussion about what is this, and I'm challenging this idea that we have an Islamic structure or model, historical model already, which is, I think, not the way to discuss. But we need to have a discussion on that. There is something which is really important, mainly what the discourse is all about, coming from the old Islamic tradition, is to speak about obligation and prohibition. We need an Islamic discourse on rights. So here, for example, we're discussing about what is the relationship, really the deep discussion about human rights and what you call Islamic rights. Is there a contradiction? And my point is that there is no contradiction here, but we need to have at least this debate and to come to a deep debate in the Islamic majority countries on that. And once again, to speak about the democratic principles and not to be obsessed with the democratic models. These are the discussions that are needed from within. But to do that, we need political freedom. We need something which is an open society, open to public debate. The first one who was saying that, for example, among the Islamists, and he was, a few years ago, he was really criticized by the Muslim activists and the Islamist movement in the majority Islamic countries, was Rashid Rannouchi. Rashid Rannouchi is based now in London, in UK. And he was the first to say, democracy is not something that we are against. You can use the concept and we can use the principles. And the great majority of the movements were, no way. It's not. This was 20 years ago, 15 years ago. And now they are moving. So here, if you look at Morocco, Turkey is a very interesting case. We have to study because the people were coming from an Islamist agenda and they are moving and say, okay, we are respecting the way the state is organized and we are promoting a strong and determined democracy. Indonesia, you have millions of Muslims involved in the syndicates and when you go there, Muhammadiyya, Nahdlatul Ulama, I went there, I sat with, and you see that the people are moving. So it's not only us as Western Muslims that are coming with new ideas. They are coming, they are moving. There is no static reality. And here it's really important. In Egypt, for example, exactly the same. The discourse of the Muslim Brothers and Muslim Brotherhood organization is not the same now as it was 20 years ago. And in Iran, in 20 years, the discussion, even though now we have something which is the conservative coming back, but not because of the internal debate, because of what is going on around, and the American policies, mainly what is going on around, is helping the conservatives to come back. It's not something which is internal. But we have a discussion inside, and all the debates and the principles coming from this debate, conservatives and reformists, is really important. It's really important when you have, for example, Khadiver or Sarouche, all these people who are doing, coming with, from within a debate, which is really important. These are moving reality. I'm coming to the end. Moving reality, and I think that this is really important to know that it's evolving, but to trust this evolution. And this is a very important point. Once again, some are saying, okay, they are evolving and it's a mutation here. It's just a political game. In fact, we don't trust their evolution. And when they are moving and changing, say, okay, they are speaking now about democracy because, and I think that maybe it's like this, but it's not always like this. At least we have to challenge it to open the debate on what they are saying and not always thinking that what they have behind their mind is something which is totally opposite to the, in contradiction with what they are saying. It means here something which is what I think we have to support is the birth of a civil society in the Islamic majority countries. And it's already there in many countries. In Indonesia, you have it. You have a public debate. We have it in Malaysia. But in many countries, we don't have this civil society, the birth of this civil society, meaning by that we need intra-community debates, political freedom, and diversity of voices. And one main point on this, because I really think that we need to open our understanding to all the voices within the Islamic majority countries. And of course, we have people who are thinking like us. They can use exactly the terminology. They were educated in the West, and they are using exactly the same terminology. But you have other groups and other trends that are not. They are using, for example, Islamic reference, but the principles are not different. And sometimes we have to be very cautious not to think that because we don't understand what they say or the way they are saying it, it's opposite to what we want. And here, I think that the discourse we have now in the West about what we call political Islam is very simplistic. Political Islam is as diverse as Christians in politics. It ranges from liberation theology that we have in South America to fundamentalists. That you have literalists in Islam, yes, they are here, and you have people who are reformists. They are using Islam as a political tool, as a political within the realm of politics, but they are not all the same. The perception that everything dealing with political Islam is against democracy, is against freedom, should be challenged. And I think we have to look at the reality out of a diversity of voices. And if we are not opening our understanding towards the differences and the complexity of this reality, I don't think that we are getting the point and opening with the Islamic majority country. And I say that why? Because I think that we all have to understand, and maybe during the discussion we will speak about what happened, you know, in Gaza and Hamas, and I think that we need to understand that Islam is part of the future of the Islamic. It's something, it's a reference which is here. You cannot just avoid it. You have to take it into account. So in which way and how? This is the discussion. The literalists are people saying, in the name of Islam, we can go towards democracy. And we have example of evolution here, and I think that this is really important. So my conclusion here, I think that, as I said, we have to engage and to promote democratization, is for us, from where we are, as Western Muslims are promoting democratization in the Islamic majority countries is really to stick to our principles. And as I said, the democratic principles for me are not disputable. This is what we have to say. Say, okay, look, you can speak about your culture, you can speak about the reality of your specificities, but the principles are the principles and we have to stick to that. It's also something which is really important. We may disagree with the people, but you have to listen to the people. If you are open to democracy, even though you don't agree with what they are choosing, there is one way just to, you know, you cannot say we are going to change the people. They are voting, and sometimes it's against, but it helps me also out of history and experiences to change. And for us to stick to our principles, as I said, and to be consistent, as I said, here in the West and there in the Islamic majority countries. And it's important. So out of this, the point for me is, the conclusion is this. It's all this is about principles, it's about consistency, it's about being involved and saying that I have no problem at the same time to be fully Muslim and to promote that. And I think that in the Islamic world, you have voices now asking for more democracy, asking for the birth of a civil society and asking for more political freedom. They are here and we have to listen to all the voices. I think that this is really important as long as the people are saying we respect the rules of democracy, we will not use violence, we are not promoting this kind of terrorism. This is something which is, you know, killing innocent people. This is something that we have also to be very clear about where we stand on that. There is something which is important, is that now in the Islamic majority countries, people are also aware that we are dealing with domination. So we have to ask ourselves, when the people in the Islamic majority countries are saying, look, when they look at the West, the perception is we are dealing with a dominant culture, a dominant civilization. So they are saying our principles are as universal as yours. Are we ready to listen to that? Are we ready to think about people saying our principles coming from our tradition as universal as yours, and you don't have to impose not only the principles, because we, in fact, my position is to say we share these principles, but your models in the name of your domination. So to be able to accept that we have both universal values. Once I was speaking with Alain Grèche, the editor, the chief editor of Le Monde Diplomatique, and he was saying, the universal Western values. And you have Muslims saying exactly the same, the Islamic universal values. And maybe you have to speak about common universal values. And here is the point. So here is a very important point. And out of our experiences in the West, I really think that we are helping and we can help a great deal the process of democratization, because we are just showing that we can be both at the same time, that we are Muslims, that we are Democrats, and that we are happy within the system of being able to speak out and to be critical and self-critical. This is a very important point, but we have to work together to fill some gaps. And the first, as I said, is mutual trust. If we are not able to trust each other in Britain, are we going to trust what is going on in the Islamic majority countries? And there is a lack of trust here. Lack of trust is perception, but it has a consequence. And the second point, I have two. The second point is about listen to what the people are saying, the way they are saying it, to avoid something which I am always critical of, its interactive monologue. You say that you dialogue, but in fact you dialogue with the people who are speaking exactly like you. It's an interactive monologue. It's not a dialogue. And you have to be able to decenter ourselves from our own terminology, our own history, our own points of reference, to be able to listen to the people where they come from to get the common to the common ground and the common principles. This is important. And the last point is to accept to share. We are sharing principles. We are sharing hopes. Are we ready to share powers? Because this is the future. Democracy is about powers and to share powers. I'm not sure that we are consistent on that field. We are ready to share hopes, not so much powers. Thank you.
Many thanks. We are now ready to take some questions. Professor Ramadan has graciously accepted to entertain different kinds of questions from the audience. For purposes not just of clarifying to those of you in this room, but for purposes of clarifying to those in a room up on the sixth floor, I'd like to just repeat the question articulated from the audience. And if you could not just speak clearly, but identify yourself so that those in the audience know where the question is coming from in terms of personality. Here on my left, first.
My name is Frank Gelli. With much which was admirable in your lecture, and I was really impressed. But may I be a little bit challenging and tell you what a young Muslim friend of mine, his name is Mohammed, surprise, surprise, told me when I told him this morning I was coming to listen to a lecture by Professor Ramadan. He said, "Oh yes, oh him." He said, "Yes, he's bright, but you know, he's Tony Blair's man. He never talks about Islam. He talks about all the things which you know, the West is plugging about secularism, about he never talks about Quran, about Sharia, and so on. And you know, he really is really sort of not a real Muslim." Well, how would you answer him?
So, for those of you up on the sixth floor, are you simply a stooge for Tony Blair?
I will answer this, and maybe after we take more than one question. Yeah. Look, I know that some Muslims are reacting that way, and you know, from the very beginning, I knew that my project was to be controversial, but I think it's constructively controversial. Because for some Westerners, I'm too much a Muslim. And for some Muslims, I'm too much a Westerner. And I think that the only advice I can give to someone who is saying that is just, look, go and read, and you will see if I'm not speaking about Islam and the Quran and the, you know, many years, I don't know, more than 15 years dealing with the Islamic tradition and the books and the classical books. So I'm speaking about that. And mainly, you know, I'm from the very, you know, when I was to go to the States at Notre Dame University, they was asking and they were looking for someone who was what they called an activist scholar. And it's exactly what I'm doing, working within academia, but I'm always at the grassroots level with Muslims and dealing and speaking on Islam, on the Quran, and the way we are. So this, you know, audiences and speaking to Muslims, with Muslims, listening to them, it's coming from this. And I'm doing this always in Europe, in the States I was doing it, and in the Islamic majority countries. So I think that once again here we deal with perception. Because you accept to be in a task force, say, okay, you are just working for him, meaning Tony Blair. I'm not. And I said it from the very beginning. I think that Muslims should be involved in this as Democrats and to say in which way we have to prevent radicalization and extremism. But I will never, never, never keep silent on the fact that I think that the British policies towards the Islamic world and mainly what happened in Iraq was a mistake. And I will continue to do that. So this is my advice to him. Read and listen.
So we have a lot of people. One, and then another in the back, and then one up front, another up front, and then that gives us four questions. Is that all right? So you first, the middle, sir. Yeah. You.
There's a lot of cynicism about democracy in most Western countries, and as you know, the turnout in elections has gone down, and people who feel disadvantaged are less likely to take part in politics or be active citizens. And I think racism is a feature in that, because people feel that their voices are going to be ignored. I wonder how you feel people can be encouraged to gain confidence that they can be effective citizens, and how they can be believe that the system can be responsive to their point of view.
Way in the back, the very back, lady in the back.
Good evening. My name is. Can you hear me? Yeah. My name is Maud Pelletier. I'm French. I think that the French democratic model is very much in line with what you were describing about secularism and the difference between the private and the public realm. So I would like to have your view on what you think we got wrong, what you think the French society got wrong, and what you think the young French Muslim got wrong as well. Thank you.
Thank you. And in the front, first of two, go ahead.
It's coming.
I spent the last 3 years in Palestine, and I came back 2 days ago, and I was an international observer in the last elections, as much as I was in the 1 year ago in the presidential elections. So as the votes were getting counted, even the Palestinians were super surprised. Even Hamas was super surprised. And they tried to tell us, okay, the majority voted for Hamas, but the majority is not Hamas. I mean, this is a punishment of Fatah, etc., etc. In any case, this is a very complex issue. It involves domestic issues and foreign issues and the donor community of responsibilities, etc. I would like very much to hear your comments about, I mean, the voting and the turnout, and also what do you expect is going to be the performance of Hamas as Palestinian government.
I'm a master's student in international relations. You argue that there are some shared principles between the Muslim world and democracy. But if we look at, for instance, the principle of the rule of law, you can stick to the rule of law, but you also have to look at the content of the law. And for instance, if you have a law, a democratic law that runs against Islamic law, a law from the Muslim world, from Islam, there is a problem, and you can still stick to the principle of law, but you still have a controversy here.
Why don't we take one more question from over there, and then we'll get some answers.
Hello, my name is Omar Al-Mughi. I'm a PhD student at the LSE. I just wanted to know, I mean, your perception about the role of Western powers. I mean, do they really want democracy in the Middle East? I mean, their role and their impact upon political development in the Middle East. And would you think their, you know, their perception of democracy in the Middle East and whether they want it or not has changed with the development of Islamic political thought? Like, for example, as you said about Muslim Brothers and accepting pluralism and whatnot. Thank you.
Okay, we have five questions. One on sort of cynicism and apathy and overcoming that in established democracies, a question on the problems in France and what's the problem with the French model, a question on the Palestinian elections, and a question on not just the rule of law, but the content of law and problems and contradictions there, and last on underlying Western preferences and with regard to democracy in the Middle East.
Okay. Yes, I think you are totally right. There is a great deal of cynicism today about in which way we are a democrat and we are citizen, and there is the perception that it's not going to change anything if we vote or we do not vote. And I think that this is really a challenge per se. When you are dealing, you know, in Europe, but also it was exactly the same in the States when I was going there, and in I was recently in Australia last few months, and the perception is there is no way it's not going to change. And look, we were millions to demonstrate against the Iraqi war, and the war in Iraq, it did not change anything. The government did what they wanted to do, and that's it. And the facts are speaking against, you know, the discourse of being involved. Now, I think that there is exactly what you said, which is something that we have to build, at least when we are speaking within the Muslim community, is self-confidence, is principles, and you are at home, and you have to try to promote this duty, I think, this individual, moral, and civic duty to try to change your society for the better. So I think that this education at the grassroots, this participatory democracy at the local level, it's really important, and is the only way to let the people feel that they can change something. But we also need from the political arena, from the politicians, to be able to do something at the local level. This is why I'm saying that throughout the Western countries, what we need are national movements of local initiatives, that we need something that the people they can be committed, and they can feel that they are changing something, that they are building an awareness, that they are doing something. It's a very difficult thing, because the great majority of the people are just saying, okay, what is the point? It's not going to change anything. And I think that we have to reconcile ourselves with political participation, political awareness, and to be committed in our society, because at the end of the day, it could change something, and that you have to build this. So self-confidence, local commitment, domestic politics, policies, also that's something that we need to do. And I'm I'm using when I'm speaking to Muslims, the framework of the Muslim, the Islamic teaching. Say, okay, look, in which way you have to build to nurture your perception of your individual responsibility towards the collectivity you live in. So this is to be involved. But I really think that the common discourse, the average discourse in the West today, and the way democracies are working, once again, it's exactly what I said, a gap between the ideals and the practices. And I think that we have to all together to come to struggle on that. It's not only something that should be done within the communities or among Muslims. We need local partnerships. We need to be partners on that. We need to be common to understand that we are equal and common citizens in our countries. And it's a deep challenge. But I think that at least we have to work at the local level and to try to build this awareness. About the French model, it's not only I was just trying to give an overall picture of democratic principles, and of course French is fitting in this picture. I think that the problem in France, I'm defending the French model in Britain, which is quite interesting for someone who went through what I went through in France. Because it's difficult, the situation is quite difficult in France, and the average, the public discussion and debate is really tainted by other, political agendas. But there is something which is important, I think, is the problem. I will never do something in Europe and among the European countries. I will never compare the models. And I think that to say that the British model is better than the French model is totally useless. It's not the point. Because different histories, different things, and you will find assets and liabilities in every single model in Europe. So if you have now to assess what is wrong with the French model, is really, really something which is that there is, as I said, a gap between the ideals, the unity of the republic, and what is going on the ground. And it's as if in France you have the suburbs and the unity of the republic and all, it's wrong. You have ghettos, and the ghettos are not only the Arab ghettos or the ghettos of the French citizen coming from outside. You have white ghettos. You have people having money and they live in ghettos and they live among themselves. You have people that are not really living in what we call the unity of the republic. And this is one. The second is, yes, there is something which is a reality when you deal with the laws in France, is that you have second-class citizens. And there is something which is an institutionalized discrimination. It doesn't mean, I will never say that France is a racist country. I heard that last week here in London, someone saying to me, oh, the French model, it's just, we are dealing, they are racist. I think that this is totally wrong. This is not what we can and we must say about the French model. But at least we have to come to look, the French psyche is failing to consider that the French society has changed. This is the reality. France is no longer what France was 30 years ago. Now you have people coming from all these different countries and they are citizens and you have to build with them and you have to act against discriminations, against racism, and to meet the conditions helping you to get to the ideals. And this is not happening today in France. And when you are, an Arab citizen, as the perception is, a French citizen with an Arab background and a Muslim background, you are thought to be dealing with these problems. You are dealing with your own community. So we speak about secularism. But in times of election, you have mayors going to the mosque saying, if you vote for me, I'm going to help you. This is against the secular system. This is once again something which is totally wrong. So I really think that we have to change this. And this is why self-confidence, citizenship, and coming to the mainstream is the future for the French Muslim citizens. And to get rid of one thing, this obsession of speaking about the fact that Islam per se is preventing the French citizens to be integrated in the society. My main point is to say today to the French debate, Islam is not a problem. We don't have a problem with the secular law. The problems are socio-economic problems and social integration and schools. Let us speak about that and not avoid speaking about that in the name of a wrong debate on Islam and Islamic principles. 6 months, speaking 6 months out of a passionate debate about preventing young Muslims to go to schools because they wear the headscarf. 6 months on that, where when you go to the suburbs and you look and you assess the situation of the schools, you say, do we not have major problems here that we have to solve and not to get rid of this discussion? I was saying, just one example, because it's a very deep discussion there, but it's also here, which is important in all the European countries. You have, I wrote an article, and it was an open letter to the Minister of Education and the Home Minister, saying, look, we need social policies, new social policies, and something which is a more equal school system. We don't want second-class schools in the suburbs. And the newspapers changed the title, saying, against the law on headscarf. It was not the point. I was saying, I don't want to speak about it. I want to speak about, but they are obsessed with the discussion. I think that, look, it's not the point. I think that we didn't have a problem with the French law, and it's to create the problem, they changed the law. In fact, they changed the law. They add something to the French law in order to ban the young Muslim students. And I think that it's a wrong debate of avoiding the right questions. About Hamas, I think that there is something that we have to stick to the democratic process, and this is why all the world is silent and okay, what is happening there. I think that we have to see, I don't know what's going to happen. Hamas has changed during the last 20 years and mainly during the last 5 years. The previous elections, they refused to be part because it was under the Oslo agreement, and now they are accepting, so they are moving and they are changing strategy. We have also to ask ourselves, who made them win? Is it only the corruption in the Fatah, or is it also Sharon's policy? Because he has a great deal of responsibility in what is going on now in the Middle East. I think that we were told, yes, in Oslo, but we were told Arafat is not the one. Okay, Arafat passed away, and Abbas was not the one. So who is the one? There is no one. And the problem is that we were asked in the Palestinian side, there is no one who is fitting the job, who can get the job of discussing. My point is Sharon the one we can speak with? I don't think so. I don't think that he has changed a lot. I think that he's very clever, and he knows exactly, and what he said, I am giving you Gaza, and at the same time, what he did in West Bank is exactly, he took more than what he gave. And we are all silent. And I think that, and we are asking, the Palestinians, you have to recognize the Israeli state according to the United Nations resolutions. Okay, under the same condition, we have to ask the Israeli government to recognize the borders of the United Nations resolutions. But there is a double standard here. So my point is to be still very critical towards the positions and the silence of the Western countries and mainly of Europe. And I think that Europe is not doing so. Now we heard that the Americans are not going to support the Hamas government government, and then the Europeans are still hesitating. Let us see what is going to happen. But the people who are saying today this is the end of the peace process should remember that the end of the peace process happened a few years ago and not now. So I think that we have to be honest with this, that there is no peace process, and there was no peace process for the last few years. And let us not just use what is happening now to say the peace process, look, I don't know. I'm upset with this issue and our silence. And I really think that as a Western Democrat in this country, I think that we all together should say something. It's not because the media are not covering what is going on there that we have to forget the suffering of the Palestinian people. And this is to be truly Democrat. Democracy is not to follow the media what they are speaking about oppression. Is to stick to principles even when the media are silent. I think that maybe you have to think about it. You are totally right, and I think that this is why I said we have to build a discourse. Rule of law could be a perception that, yes, it's a law, but it's a discriminatory law. So we have to be here in a discussion. And my main concern is that when the people are speaking about what is an Islamic law, we have to discuss about it and in which way it's perceived. I take one example. I was criticized by many Muslim scholars in the Islamic majority countries. It was really, I expected something like that, but not so strong. When I said, look, the penal code, known as al-hudud, in the Islamic majority countries, what is done now, and it could be in some countries, like in Saudi Arabia, for example, it's part of the rule of law. So it's used today as something which is Islamic. But in fact, when you assess the situation, it's plain injustice and discrimination against women and against poor people. Never, never against the kings and the presidents. That are those who are stealing more money than everyone else. So here is to say, look, in the name of the Islamic teaching, in the name of the Islamic, we have to reassess what you are presenting as something which is an Islamic law in the name of justice, because it's unjust to do it as it's done, and we need an intra-community debate on this. So I think that in every single situation, it's really important to have a debate and say, okay, I'm not against the Islamic teaching, but the Islamic teaching also have conditions, and we have to look at the context. We cannot just take from a literal understanding of the text and to implement that. It's plain injustice. So here it's a critical understanding in the name of Islam against what is done in the name of Islam and unjustly against people who are doubly victims. So you are right. It's not because we are speaking about rule of law that we are getting justice. So this is why I was saying we need to build a discourse and to open a debate on what we want and in which way we are faithful to the legal framework helping us to get justice and helping us to have equal citizenship. Because still, for example, you know, I was in Malaysia and I was told, look, the people, the Muslims and the non-Muslims have the same rights. It's wrong. It's wrong. When you are a non-Muslim in Malaysia, your right to express yourself or to organize yourself or to get a public way to speak is not the same. It's not. So there is a problem here. We are asking here about freedom of worship and freedom of conscience, and you go to countries, Islamic majority countries, and you have something which is not equal rights. And Muslims are saying, look, this is the way Islam is all about. And we can just refer to something which was said by the Prophet of Islam, saying, speaking about the Jews in Medina, لَهُمْ مَلَنَا وَعَلَيْهِمْ مَعَلَيْنَا, meaning they have the same rights and the same duties as us. What does it mean today, this, in which we were organizing? So this is why I think that it's not enough to speak about rule of law. We have to go further and to say, okay, what about justice? In which way we are speaking about justice? And even the perception, the different, you know, understanding of what we have, dhimmi, you know, non-Muslims under Islamic majority, you know, governments, is something that we have to speak about. What do we mean today about this? You know, I think it's really important, and this is a point which is to come to a critical understanding of the Islamic reference with some groups and with some trends. Very quickly about the Western role, in which way we... I think that it's a very difficult question, what kind of role do we want the West to play, and or is this role evolving? I think that, as I said, the first is to stick to the principles, is to be consistent. And, you know, you cannot just foolish the people. They are not going to listen to, you know, teachings about democracy when we see what is going on. So the first message is to try to be more consistent and not only, you know, who thinks in the Islamic majority countries and even in the West that what was done in Iraq was to liberate the Iraqi population and not to set a specific geostrategic interest agenda or to preserve and to protect economic interest. I think that 99.9% of the Muslims in the Islamic majority country, they have just this perception. It has nothing to do with democracy. And if it's about democracy, let us start with Saudi Arabia. Why not? Sometimes money. This is the reality. I think that we have to be here. Consistency is the point. And here, us as citizens in our country here, we need to be the voice for this. The only way for me to be consistent at the international level is to be consistent here. You say, okay, look, we are speaking about democracy. And, you know, for example, what happened? We condemn the suicide bombings in July 7th. It has to be condemned. It must be condemned. No discussion about that. But when you are dealing with politicians here and they are saying, look, condemn, but don't speak about Iraq. Say, okay, look, how are you going to be listened by the people if when it comes to the point, which is when Tony Blair said there is no relationship between July the 7th and the Iraqi situation, on the ethical ground, he was right. Once again, I'm always saying that. He's right. You cannot justify what happened in this country in the name of what was done in Iraq. No way. It's to be condemned and there is no discussion. The ethical ground, he's right. On the political ground, he's wrong. Of course, the people are saying, you are killing our people. We are going to kill your people. It's a wrong message. But you have to deal with it. What are you doing in Iraq? What are you doing? Why are you silent in Palestine? Are you silent? And I think that here we need to be more involved in this as West British citizens. And we need to say, stick to the principle. And one thing which is really important, be able to listen to the different voices coming from the Islamic majority countries, not only the people who are speaking like you, not only the people who are selling their country, but people who are saying, okay, look, we have principles, we are trying out of our values. And here, I think that there is apparently a change, at least in the political discourse, about the fact that we are going to deal with other groups and open democracy, to be more open to democracy. We'll see how it goes. To stick to the principles and to open the channels for more debate and discussion is the way, I think, and not to impose models, because imposing models is not going to work.
Okay, one question here, and here, then we have one from up top, and then we're really overstaying our welcome here. Okay, so over here first.
Professor Tariq Ramadan, Maria Almendra McBride, your curriculum vitae humbles me, and who am I to address you, but as a foreign correspondent, if I've learned anything during 3 decades in the UK, is that talk is cheap, deception is easy and usual, and illusion is a tool. Now, how would you propose women in the Middle East to improve their situation when they are trapped over there within a framework? And also, may I have the temerity of advising you that if you speak of South America, you leave out the rest of the region, because the Latin Americans also include the Caribbean Basin and several other very diverse countries. And finally, does a flag, nationality, race, origin, gender, affiliation, religion, Eastern or Western, make a human being better or worse?
My name is Jim Kennedy. As an octogenarian, I'm no longer affiliated. My question is prompted by your remark, Professor Ramadan, about schools. Last week here at LSE, Professor Amartya Sen expressed grave reservations about the growing number of faith schools, no matter what sponsoring revealed belief system is behind that, upon all. He regarded that the multiculturalist principle behind them as grossly flawed, that in fact they were more plural monisms than real multiculturalism. I wonder if you have an opinion about that.
And last but not least, up there.
My name is Abdurrahim Johnston. My name is Semitic. I'm born in South Africa, exposed to Westernism, so-called, all my life. My surname is Johnston, which is Scottish, and I feel very comfortable in my skin. Professor, you are described as the greatest innovator of the 21st century. After listening to you, to you and your eclectic ahistorical sermon, I wonder what newness you bring to the table. Thank you.
You wonder what?
After listening to your eclectic ahistorical sermon, it's a bit of a preaching this evening, I wonder what newness you bring to the table. You describe as the 21st greatest newness? Innovator. What's the innovation that you're talking about? Is there any? If so, what is it?
Okay, a final set of responses, and then we'll call it quits.
Okay. I'm not sure that I understood the last part of your questions, but I think that the first part was mainly about women in the Middle East and in which way we can empower women and the way they can be involved in the process. I think that what is going on now, not only in the Middle East but within the Islamic majority countries, is really something which is more and more women involved in within the public sphere, in the social field, and even in politics. It's not enough, but I think that there is two things that are in process now, in motion at least. It's something which is a rereading of the Islamic sources and promoting something which is a better understanding and a new understanding, because we are in a new context of women rights, women involvement in society, the right to work, and things that are, you know, in the last book I am speaking about the birth of an Islamic feminism. But feminism not in the way men against women or women against men, but also something which is men and women in the name of a better understanding of the context of the Islamic teachings against cultural discriminations and for example, also literalist readings. So let me give you examples. I think that if you go to Turkey today, or in Indonesia, you know, I was meeting the Council of Ulama in Indonesia. It is the only one where you can find, out of 36 Muslim scholars, 7 women. You will never find this today in the Arab countries. But I think that things are moving, that you have women involved. We were last year in Niger, and we had something which an international conference. And one panel was a full afternoon on women involvement in Africa. And they were dealing with forced marriages, violence, cultural discriminations. And this is also new. And you are women, they are the most... the more involved in the process. I really think that something is moving. Now, even in North Africa, in Morocco, for example, you have women more and more, and you have, for example, a kind of network of Muslim women dealing with a new reading of the sources with Muslim scholars and trying to promote a better understanding. So, and something which is a kind of liberation of oppression which is based once again on culture, because there is something that we have to accept and say, you know, I gave a lecture last week here and I was also challenged with Muslims saying that our cultures of origin in these majority country, Islamic countries, are very, you know, the culture are very macho. And it's not Islamic per se, it's coming from the culture, and that we have to challenge the culture with the principles. And it's also the same with literalists taking some verses, and this is Islamic. So this process, it's really important, and we need that. And I think that the work which is done, it's not enough. Once again, it's not enough, but it's something which is happening, and we need this more. And as I said, we need a clear discourse on many things. And for example, you know, forced marriages, domestic violence, the fact that we have to say it clearly for the same with the same competence, doing the same work, we need to get the same salary, and the right to divorce. All these are principles that are Islamic, and we have to set up the agenda in order to move on that field. And I think that this is a really important thing towards democratization in the Islamic majority countries, but also a new awareness among Western Muslims as well. About the schools, two things. The first is the ideal for me is mainstream school system where the people are together. This is the ideal. And I was raised and was educated in schools like that. And I think that this immediate reactions from Muslims to say, we have problem in the mainstream school system, let us have our own Islamic schools. Behind it is, let us protect ourselves from the surrounding society. And mainly we started with schools for girls to protect them more. I think this reaction behind, it's very dangerous because it's self-segregation. So the ideal is let us be together, and I think that the Islamic schools are not the panacea. This is the ideal. Let us look at what is going on the ground in the mainstream school system in Britain. The problem is that when you go to some areas, the mainstream school, the school representing the state school, the school which where to gather all the people, are already 98% with people coming from the same having the same background, Pakistani background or British British citizens, but with an Islamic Muslims or with a Pakistani background, and very often not at the same level as the schools that we get in white areas. So we have a process which is a vicious process, naturally done because we put the people coming from the same, you know, areas in the same places. This urban policy did not help us to come together. So when now you have people saying we are setting face schools and they are succeeding, you know, the figures, and you know, in fact they are not less integrated than the people coming from these schools. This is the reality of the figures. They are not less integrated. It's a reality that, you know, I'm saying that I'm not promoting faith schools, and I wrote this. I think it's not the way forward. I'm not against the principle. If someone is coming and telling me, look, this Islamic school, it's not only about gathering the Muslims together, but coming with new pedagogical ways of, you know, innovative way of teaching. For example, Montessori. People coming with, if it's this that you are trying to do, it's to be innovative. No, okay, do it. Private schools with innovative, you know, approaches, it's all good. But if it's too self-segregated, it's not good. Now, this is my position on that. But if I look at the situation, I was speaking with people coming with this, and they were saying, okay, it's good, but this is theory. Look at the ground and you will see that we are among ourselves. Because the system in this society is to put the Pakistani together, and we have a multiculturalism which is not people reaching out, it's a patchwork of communities. So if you have a patchwork of schools, so let us come to this and say, okay, how could we change that? Are you going to be able to say to the people living in this, you have to travel 5-10 miles to get to another schools, to other schools there, to mix? You have people doing that, but the great majority say, okay, look, the school is there, just near my house. I'm not going to go there to mix. So here we have to come with something which is to find a way to help the people to mix and to come together. It's not the case in the great majority of the schools that we have in these areas. So we need something which is urban and social policy, maybe not to ask the people to move, but to have a policy around the school, helping the people, two schools, to come together and to reach and to do something together. It's something which is, if you cannot have people coming from different backgrounds in the same school, let us create bridges among schools. We have to come with creative things, because you cannot ask the people to move. They are not going to move. They are not going to send their children 10 miles away from home. So we are in a vicious circle. We don't know how to do. And people are saying, okay, this is the situation. Let us have our schools, face schools, people together, and the results are not bad, in fact. This is one. And the second is that they are challenging. Why are you starting to speak about that now, when for decades we have private religious schools, Christian, Jewish schools, and you said nothing? Why with Muslims? It's a good question, by the way, isn't it? So it doesn't mean that we don't have to tackle the issue, and I agree with him on the ideal that we have to come together. I learned a lot by being with people who are not from my background, not from my religion, and coming together. But I was in a society where in Switzerland, we were really together. It's not the case here. So we maybe have to be more creative in the way we think about educative policy and how we speak, how we deal with schools in the way we are trying to let the people to come together. Because now they are not together. Even if they are not in faith schools, they are not together because the urban policy is not helping them to come together. And the reality of, you know, social fractures and social conditions are not the same. And the last is, what is new? I don't know if, you know, you are referring to what the Times was saying, you know, one of the 100 more innovative. It's the Times, not me. What I'm trying to do, don't assess what I'm trying to do, is just to come with, look, what I'm trying to do is this, just to be very simple. I'm coming from, I'm a Muslim, I'm a practicing Muslim, and I studied the classical Islamic tradition. I came back to this, and I'm asking myself, in which way should I reread this classical tradition in order to come with new answers to new questions and challenges? I'm just trying to do that. You may say, but what he's saying is not new. And maybe there is nothing new. And very often now I'm saying, what I'm saying is not new. Very often I'm saying that. You know, the reformist tradition is not new. It's as old as Islam. But I'm trying to say, okay, for example, about being a Westerner and being a Muslim, common values, coming together. The question is not that it's maybe it's new in the way you are saying it, but the way you are articulating these two realities and two belongings and together, and so there is no contradiction, and to build this confidence out of this understanding, this is what I'm trying to do. So this is within the Islamic tradition, and all the books I'm writing, the first part of the books are always rooted in the Islamic tradition, and then I'm coming with practical answers to practical issues. I'm trying to do that. So it may be not new. This is a simple and humble objective. The second is that I was raised and I studied the Western philosophy and the Western tradition. I'm here. You know, my first PhD was on Nietzsche's philosophy. And by doing that, I'm just now reassessing the fact that I am a European, and I have also some questions to my fellow citizens, and I think that we have to be self-critical. So here is also to come to my fellow citizens and to put some questions and to direct maybe some answers in the way we have all together to decenter ourselves from our points of reference to understand the other, meaning by that, building bridges. And by building bridges, I am, as I said, I know and I knew that you are not going to be accepted on both sides. So at the middle of the bridge, you may say, no, nothing new in this, maybe. The only thing for me is just to say, but let us be both self-critical. So self-critical with Muslims, among Muslims, and also self-critical with my Westerners, fellow citizens, and say, okay, look, we also have to ask ourselves what we are doing, in which we are speaking our values, the gap between the ideals and the practices, and to let us come together and to create partnerships. Partnership is a very old idea, but maybe there is a new way to think about it.